Hello, everyone. Morning. So we're nearing the end of our sermon series about Let Me Ask You a Question. And I'm just curious how many others of you have enjoyed this series. So I've really enjoyed it. I feel like life is so busy and things just keep rolling. And so anything that causes me to like slow down and notice what's happening in my own heart is a really good thing, a good gift right now. And when Jesus asks questions, that's exactly what happens. We have learned Jesus was asked 183 questions, but yet he only answered three of them. Instead, he asked people 307 questions. So Jesus was this always asking questions. And why is this significant? Because questions show interest. Jesus is interested in how we think and how we feel, where we're heading. When you ask a question, it usually means you have time to listen to an answer, and Jesus has time for us. There's time to respond, there's time to think, there's time to reflect. Questions show engagement. Jesus wants a dialogue, he wants a relationship, he wants conversation. And questions have the power to cut deep. And Jesus is always certainly do. They cut right to the heart of the matter. They expose something deep within us that we have to then reckon with. So today our question comes from Mark 8. And scholars, if you're reading the book of Mark, would say that this chapter, Mark 8, is the pivotal chapter in Mark. It shows the crux, the climax. It's the moment where we can make sense of everything that Jesus has been doing. The healings, the miracles, the teachings. And up until now, Jesus has not revealed his identity. But in this story, there's the unveiling. And surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, the unveiling does not happen by an authoritarian Jesus decree, but the unveiling happens in a question. Who do you say I am? This is our question for this morning. It's a simple question, but it has profound implications. Jesus is looking for a serious conversation about who we've come to know him to be. What do we know of him? Can we name it? When we name who Jesus is, it affects how we see Jesus and how we relate with Jesus. So this knowledge, this knowing, this naming of who Jesus is transforms our way of being. When I was thinking of a story about how this works, I was reminded of a story that Jocelyn shared in worship one Sunday morning, and I asked her permission. She said I could share it again. But she was talking about her foster daughter and how she was a little bit detached, but was slowly warming up to them. And then one morning, Sherwood picked her up and threw her over his shoulder and started carrying her, and the daughter started to say, "Daddy, Daddy." And it was hesitant and it was awkward at first, but then she started to say it again, "Daddy, Daddy," and got more confident, and "Daddy, Daddy," and got more full of delight. Her naming Sherwood took their relationship to another level. Daddy. The words we use to describe Jesus, the name we give Jesus, it carries an impact because it signifies a shift in our understanding of who Jesus is and what that does for our relationship, how we relate to Jesus. So this is a question, who do you say I am, is a very exciting question because it changes us. So we're going to dive into our text. So if you have an app, you can. I'll put it on the screen. We're in Mark 8, starting at verse 27. So the conversation begins with Jesus on a road with his disciples. They had just been in a town called Bethsaida, and I like just to have a map to show us where we are. So we're right on the very north tip of the Sea of Galilee in a town called Bethsaida. And then Jesus had just fed the 4,000, and there was 7 loaves of bread left. And then Jesus healed a blind man. And now Jesus and his disciples are walking up to Caesarea Philippi. So this isn't a short walk, it's a 20-mile walk. Maybe it felt pretty normal to them, but for us that's like a 8 to 10-hour full-day walk. So they're going for a walk together, Jesus and his closest followers, spending the day on the journey, walking to the next town. So let's read. This is starting at verse 27. Jesus and his disciples left Galilee and went up to the villages near Caesarea Philippi. And as they were walking along, he asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" "Well," they replied, "some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, others say that you are one of the prophets." And then he asked them, "But who do you say I am?" And Peter replied, "You are the Messiah." But Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Okay, so this is our passage. And Jesus actually asked two questions, and I'm wondering if you can see them both. Anyone? Who do people say I am? And who do you say I am? So let's start with the first one. Who do people say I am? We can call this the warm-up question. The disciples had been spending lengthy amounts of time with Jesus. They were watching his interactions with people, watching the way he would heal, listening to his teachings, watching the miracles, watching the demons flee. The disciples were taking this all in. And now Jesus asks them, "So, who do people say that I am?" He's asking them to reflect on the chatter of society. What are people around you saying about me? The truth is that more often than not, what we think about Jesus comes a lot from what other people have told us, what we hear, what we read, what we see. Our thoughts about Jesus have been shaped by what we have been taught. One way this happens is through our families. I just would like a show of hands. How many of you have been raised by families that talked about God or taught you about Jesus? Okay, and then opposite, how many were raised by families that did not talk about God? Okay. So either way, these things, whether we heard about God or when we didn't hear about God, have shaped how we think about Jesus. These things have impact. Another way that our thoughts of Jesus have been shaped are by our faith community or by our church. How many of you were raised in a church community or church environment? Maybe this will mostly connect with our last question, I'm guessing. How many were a part of other churches before this church here? Yeah, lots of us. So we all have those things coming to us, too, from other church communities. Walter Brueggemann talks about how our understanding of God is filtered through human imagination, and often denominations, different churches, have very different views of what God looks like. He talks about some of the high churches. Presbyterians often talk about God like a lawyer. That's part of their language. Episcopalians see God more of an artist. Beauty and loveliness is everywhere. The United Church sees God more of a social worker. Christ has no hands but our hands. And I'm sure we could dissect all the denominations, but the understanding is that different groups of people come to view God differently based on what they value. And so when we come from a different church perspective, we're getting a lens of what God is like. So, century ago, these would be the two main influencers about how we would come to know Jesus, our family and our church. But we live in an age of social media, and in between our Sunday mornings, we might be attending a church in Australia or in California or in Kansas. And I'm just curious, how many of you are affected or listen to podcasts or teachings or read books of other pastors of other churches as well as coming to church here? So we have a lot of other influence also coming in. And so it's interesting because here we are, WCV, but and yet each one of us has our own mix of influences of what we have come to know Jesus to be like. And that's all part of the picture. So when Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say I am?" he's doing what he does with every question. He's asking his disciples to just slow down and notice. What is being said about him? What are people saying? And this is a good question for us to notice and to ask ourselves as well. And how did they answer? They said, well, some people say you're like John the Baptist. Some say you're like Elijah. Some say you're like the other prophets. This is a picture of Ezekiel up there. Have any of you read any of those stories lately about these guys? They're strong, quirky, fearless men of God who spoke out against evil and injustice. They performed miracles. They brought hope to God's suffering people. And by connecting Jesus with John the Baptist, Elijah, and the prophets, we get a clue about how people were trying to wrap their brains around Jesus. They were trying to fit him into a category of something they know, something they were familiar with, something they could make sense of. This is a habit of ours. We try to discern what people are like and reduce them to a category so we can understand them and make sense of them. So if you think about it, imagine that you hear someone talking about coconut oil and chia seeds and essential oils, and you might say, oh, I see here one of those hippie granola type, like me, maybe. So that's what we do. We listen to people and we listen for the clues, right? We're trying to see a little bit, okay, I get who you are. I see what's happening. And that's what was happening with Jesus. Who is Jesus? Oh, I see. He's this wild, unpredictable, but powerfully anointed prophet. Now I understand him. How often do we do that in our current culture with Jesus, too? We try to fit him into category, like, oh, Jesus, I see. He's kind of like Oprah, Tony Robbins, like a motivational coach who help us unlock our inner potential. Or maybe Jesus is like Martin Luther King, an activist calling for reconciliation. Oh, I see. For centuries, that's what we've done with Jesus. We try to put Jesus into a category that we can understand so we can make sense. Oh, Jesus, he's like the king above all kings, the Lord above all lords. He's the ultimate father, the final judge, the greatest teacher. These categories, my best friend, the bridegroom. Categories of things that we know and we try to place Jesus in. But what we have to recognize is that all of our categories are human and they're partial. And even if they capture something about Jesus, they will always distort something else. They won't be the whole picture. A few weeks ago, Andy mentioned Buddy Jesus, and I found this. This is Buddy Jesus. And Buddy Jesus, there's something great that we learn when we think about Jesus as our buddy and our friend, because we can understand the closeness of who Jesus is. But there's a distortion, because it tames Jesus too, right? Is Jesus just someone that goes along and validates everything we do? Is Jesus just a better version of ourselves that we like to hang out with? We have to be careful of how our categories don't show the whole picture. So after this question, Jesus goes one step deeper. We've just done our warm-up. And you guys feel warmed up? Okay. So now we're going to the next question, and this is the question, who do you say I am? This is the pivotal point in Mark. Mark Crossman, the man who wrote the book that we're basing this series on, says that this is the single most important question that Jesus ever asked. And why? Because it's the question on which every other question depends. It's the question underneath every question. When he asks, why do you worry? He's really asking, do you see me as trustworthy? When he asks, has no one condemned you? He's wondering, do you think I will condemn you? Who we know Jesus to be is the underlying root of how we relate, how we function. This is the most important question of our lives. And how did Peter reply? So in this moment, Peter does the math. He starts to connect all the dots. He gathers the experiences that he's had with Jesus, all the interactions, the healings, the miracles, the teachings. He's gathering the information of what people are saying about Jesus, and he pulls it all together, and he has a revelation. And he says, you are the Messiah. This is a picture I painted. It's on the wall over there. I painted it 5 years ago when we did the Peter series. I can't believe it's 5 years ago. It's crazy. But this is a painting of a moment, this pivotal moment, the first time that Jesus' identity has ever been spoken by a human. It has been spoken by demons in Mark, but this is the first time by a human that it's ever proclaimed. Jesus is beyond just another prophet. Jesus is the Messiah. This word Messiah has become quite familiar in Christian, or Christianized maybe, and we might easily lose sight of what this word would have meant for a first century Jew. What would it have meant for Peter to utter these words for the first time on that dusty road to Caesarea Philippi? This was a key word. It was a loaded word. It meant Jesus was the person they were waiting for, the person on whom all of their history rests. This was the King of Kings who would take them beyond where David could ever go, to a place of full shalom. This was their Savior who would conquer the nations, judge the world, defeat their enemies, someone who would bring peace and prosperity and justice, someone who would defeat the agents of oppression, whether they be human or supernatural. This one word, Messiah, was loaded with hope and anticipation and expectation. And we know that in times of suffering, people long for a Messiah. Messianic movements, people are looking for a Messiah when things are hard. And in the first century, under Roman domination, Roman oppression and persecution, the Jews would have been hungry for a Messiah. So this word Messiah was not just a pretty word we sing in a song. This was a politically dangerous and a theologically risky claim. It was a claim that Jesus was the true king of Israel and that any other rulers were then imposters. The Gospel of Mark notes that this confession happened on the road to Caesarea Philippi. And if you research Caesarea Philippi, it's also known as Pan, I think, it's a very important town because it is a town of very secular pagan worship. There is worship to the god Pan, the Greek god. And also they had just put up a whole temple to the Roman god, Caesar Augustus. So there's this huge temple. So as they're walking to this place where all other giant people, little g gods, were being worshipped, that's the place where Peter first says, "You are the Messiah." So it's striking. It's striking that that naming got happened right there. So we are given a clue that Peter got it right because Jesus tells him to be silent. This is the messianic secret that happens in Mark, and theologians have different theories about why that happens, and we're not going to really go into that. But what we know is that Jesus is emphasizing the weight of what was just said. It is important. It is risky. Be silent about it. This word has major implications. So years ago, when I painted this painting, this is as far as I read in the text because this is what the sermon was about, these couple verses. That's where we stopped. And current Bibles are interesting because they insert headings into the text that make it seem like things stop, right? But back in the day, Mark would have just kept writing. And so if we read the headings, it would have said what we just read was called Peter's Declaration About Jesus. And in verse 31, it changes to Jesus predicts his death, is what it changes to. But I want to read this together again without those headings, because I think it's pretty important when we hear the whole story together. So we'll start at verse 27 again. So Jesus and his disciples left Galilee, and they went up to the villages near Caesarea Philippi. And as they are walking along, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" "Well," they replied, "some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, others say you're one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say I am?" And Peter replied, "You are the Messiah." But Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Then Jesus began to tell them that the Son of Man must suffer many terrible things and be rejected by the elders and the leading priests and the teachers of the religious law. He would be killed, but 3 days later he would rise from the dead. And as he talked about this openly with his disciples, Peter took him aside and began to reprimand him for saying such things. Jesus turned around and looked at his disciples and then reprimanded Peter. Some say rebuked. "Get away from me, Satan," he said. "You are seeing things merely from a human point of view, not from God's." Then calling the crowd to join the disciples, he said, "If any of you wants to be my follower, you must give up your own way. Take up your cross and follow me. If you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake and for the sake of the good news, you will save it." So what do we notice when we keep reading? We notice that 4 verses later, in that very same conversation, on that very same dusty road, right after that pivotal moment of Jesus being named the Messiah, of Peter getting it right then, Jesus, in front of all the disciples, rebukes Peter and says, "Get behind me, Satan." This is a dramatic moment in the text. Can you feel it? This is pivotal. So following this trail, Peter has just had this great aha moment. It was his moment. He got it right. You are the Messiah. He had connected the dots. He had put Jesus in the category. I know who you are. You're the true king. You're coming to reign, to save us, to rescue, to deliver, to defeat our enemies. And just as quickly as he had spoken this, Jesus began to just teach them and break open the category and redefine what Messiah would look like. He said, "I am coming to suffer, to be rejected. I'm coming to be killed." Can you sense Peter's shock? What? So Peter pulls aside Jesus and he reprimands Jesus. And his reprimand is rooted in what he knows to be the right answer. "But you're the Messiah. You got it wrong, Jesus. There surely is another way. Messiahs don't get killed by the authorities. Messiahs come to overthrow the authorities. You've got to deliver us from the Romans." And then Jesus turns. I'm imagining this on the road, right? They're walking together. In order for Jesus to turn, he has to stop. Like, this is important. This turning, this reprimand shows urgency, shows passion. And he says, "Get behind me, Satan. You are seeing things merely from a human point of view, not from God's." Jesus speaking from conviction, from passion. Anything that takes Jesus away from his true calling is a temptation from Satan. So Peter thought he knew who Jesus was because he gave the right answer. But in this moment, Jesus shows us that any of our easy answers will get blown up as soon as they come in contact with the real Jesus. Our categories are never enough. If we dare to say who we know Jesus to be, we have to be prepared to receive the correction that comes. Our categories, our boxes, our human perceptions, our names, they are but a shadow of who Jesus really is. So then we might ask, well, then why do we even try? Why do we even try to name Jesus? And the answer is because relationship. If our goal is to be someone who has the right answer, then yeah, we should never try. Right answers, we will always fail. We should never try. But if our goal is to come to know Jesus, to be in relationship with Jesus, to know who he is, to know what he's like, to allow our understanding to change how we relate and interact, then this learning and unlearning and learning and unlearning, this is just part of the process. We know in part, and then God breaks it open and takes us deeper over and over again. So it's not coincidentally that this passage comes right after the story of the healing of the blind man. And I'm not sure if you remember that one, but it's interesting because that healing happened in two stages. Jesus spit in his hands and then rubbed it on the blind man's eyes and said, "What do you see? Do you see anything?" And he said, "I see people. They look like trees." So he had this partial healing. And then Jesus put his hands on him again, and then his sight was restored. So we had just had this story of partial seeing, then full seeing. And now we're getting this parallel story happening again with Peter. Partial seeing, you were the Messiah. I'm going to break it apart, and now you really know. So by putting these stories together, Mark and Jesus are showing us that the journey of knowing Jesus comes in stages. It comes in dialogue. It comes in relationship. Jesus asks us, "Who do you say I am?" And we might say, "You are the Messiah." And he will say, "Great, yes. But let me show you what the Messiah is." We might come and Jesus will say, "Who do you say I am?" And we might say, "You are the great rabbi, the teacher." And he will say, "Great, yes. Now follow me. Let me show you what this journey looks like." And this is what I was impacted with this week. God might say, "Who do you say I am?" And we might say, "Jesus, you are Emmanuel, God with us." And God will say, "Well, let me show you and break that apart. What does it mean for me to be with you?" For me this week, I realized that I have come to see God with us as being like the victim alongside me. And Jesus is saying, "Wait a minute, I'm also the man, the one who stops the storm. Pray for my power in this storm." So that undid me this week. So this interaction, this dialogue, this going deeper, this is from the man who wrote the book that we are talking about. We need to both dare to say who we've come to know Jesus to be and be prepared to receive the inevitable correction that comes from Jesus when our answers lead us astray. In other words, we need to be in relationship, in dialogue with Jesus. I want you to think back to that story about Jocelyn and their foster girl. So Sherwood picks her up, throws her over his shoulder, and she says, "Daddy." Is the beauty of that naming that she got the answer right? Or is the beauty of that naming that she was beginning to realize what it was like to have a daddy who loved her? That's the beauty. It's beyond the naming, and it's the relationship. She was beginning to see what it was like to have a daddy who loved her unconditionally. So this is all about relationship. Who do you say I am? It's important for us to try and name who we know God to be, to search our heart, to put it into words. But at the same time, we must always remember that our words and our language and our understanding will always fall short of who God is. But the purpose is never the right answer, the right name. The purpose is always to deepen our relationship. So are we prepared to go on this journey with Jesus? To walk with him and talk with him? To notice and recall what we've been told about Jesus? To do the work? What have people told me? What do I carry about Jesus from where I've come from? Can we do the work of naming who right now we know Jesus to be in our lives? And then can we let Jesus come in and blow that open, redefine it, expand it? That's the question. So let's do that. Okay. So I'm going to pray, and then I'm just going to invite you guys in your own minds to walk this journey, to walk this dusty road with Jesus where he asks you these same questions, and just let whatever come up and meet Jesus in the relationship on this path. Okay? So Jesus, we thank you that you ask questions, that you are interested in us, that you have time for us. You long to engage with us. We thank you for your capacity to just speak right to the root and right to the heart and cut through all the rest of society's noise. So, Lord, we just imagine ourselves on this dusty road with you where there's time to dialogue, to talk. And you ask us, who do others say that I am? So just take a moment and think about what has your family told you about Jesus? What is your faith community, whether it be past or present? What have they taught you about Jesus? And what about the other influencers in your life, whether it be authors you've read, pastors you listen to? What are they teaching you about Jesus? So God, we thank you for these things and the way that you have woven our life to bring us right here to this moment. We thank you for these influences who have taught us about you and have brought us to this place today. So now bring us deeper. Jesus turns to you and asks, so now you, who do you say that I am? I just want you to think about one or two words that defines how you view Jesus right now. So God, we thank you for this naming because it gives us a hint of something so good. Some kind of treasure you have for us. You are calling something in us in this naming, some sort of relationship. But God, we know that you are bigger than even these words. You're so much bigger. So right now we just to offer these words that have come up. We offer them back to you. And God, we just ask you to blow them up. Expand our imagination. Help us see how big, how kind, how incredible you are. We just ask for a deeper revelation. So just pray for that for a moment. So God, we thank you for these things and these ways that you are drawing us deeper. And we know that they are unto relationship. So what are you inviting us to here? What's your invitation for us?